Hi, I'm Erwin McManus, and this is the Mosaic Podcast. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And if you're one of our regular listeners, we love the fact that you journey with us, and we pray that every single message inspires you and helps you become the person that God created you to be. Every single week, we send a new message across the world, and everything we do here at Mosaic is made available to everyone in the world for absolutely free. The reason we can do that is that we have incredible people who give generously and sacrificially to make this possible. And I want to invite you to join us. If you're already a giver, thank you so much. If this is something you've not yet done, I want to invite you to start doing that now. Go to mosaic.org/give and give a one-time gift, or even beyond that, become a recurring giver here at Mosaic. And if you're one of those individuals who God has blessed in an amazing way financially, I want to invite you to become one of our partners here at Mosaic. What's really beautiful about Mosaic is that our biggest givers are families who do not live here in Los Angeles, but they are so committed to the message of Jesus going to the world that they support the work here from Los Angeles to the ends of the earth. And so I want to invite you again, go to mosaic.org/give, become a part of our support system, become one of our partners. And more than anything else, I want you to listen to the message, allow Jesus to speak to you in a way that will change your life. I wanted to begin just by reading the first few paragraphs of this new journal that really just shares many of the dreams and experiences and thoughts and promises that God has allowed me to step into. And we're calling this series, along with the book, Seizing Your Divine Moment. Let me just introduce you to some of the early thoughts. The foreshock, choices, choose to live. Deep into the night, I was walking down a dark street in the city of San Salvador, under the care of a night watchman who was returning me to my home. No more than 6 or 7 years old, I somehow slipped through the fortress-like security of my grandparents' home and found my way into the dangerous street outside. Later, Papi Ermelindo and Mami Finita even attempted to wait up with a camera to document my escape. Interrogating me was of no value since I had no recollection of the event. I was a sleepwalker, going places in my dreams where my body insisted on following. All I would ever remember was dreaming that I could fly, that I was going places I had never seen but somehow knew awaited my exploration. Such a great divide between dreams and reality, between dreams and life. How in the world is the real thing supposed to compare with what you can conjure in your imagination? Not that life was bad, but it wasn't a dream. But it didn't stop there. It wasn't just that the dreams made sleeping more attractive than living. The dreams invaded my waking hours as well. It wasn't enough to be a sleepwalker. I was also a daydreamer. I was a citizen, if not a captive, of my imagination. The places I could go, the things I could do, the person I could become were far more compelling than the life I was living. Yet even when I was playing it safe, there was an adventurer screaming to be set free. As I grew, I used books to feed my dreams. I would feed my longing to join a quest through the journeys of endless heroes. Whether it was an ancient odyssey or a futuristic enterprise, I would find adventure through their experiences. But this would only intensify my craving rather than quench it. There was a voice screaming inside my head, "Don't sleep through your dreams." Ever heard that voice? It calls you like a temptress to abandon the monotony of life and to begin an adventure. It threatens to leave you in the mundane if you refuse to risk all that you have for all that could be. If ignored, the voice dims to silence. Yet every now and again, like a siren, she sings and begins to woo you back. I think that I'm not much different than all of us in this room tonight. That inside of each one of us, there's this maybe secret, silent longing to live a life so daring, so adventurous, that everyone around us, anyone who knew, anyone who had any inkling of the story that we lived, would be envious of our lives and our journey. Even those of us who have surrendered to the mundane, who have conceded our lives to mediocrity and compromise and apathy, to routine and predictability, even inside of you, There's a little voice that occasionally raises up loud enough to create a disturbance inside of your conscience that says, don't sleep through your dreams. You were created for more than this. You were not simply brought into this world to live and die, to sleep and awaken again only to sleep. Your minutes were supposed to count for something. And then there's this tragic distortion of the message of Jesus Christ that seems to only reinforce the mundane, that only seems to add weight to our burden of a life of nothing but rules and rituals and meaningless action and reaction. It's almost as if Jesus Christ died on the cross so that we could just have better information, we can have proper beliefs, that we can have the burden of religion. And frankly, I don't think a lot of us are looking for more weight upon our shoulders or our chest, holding us down and holding us back and making freedom and life and pleasure more difficult to achieve or find or discover. Jesus has been sorely misrepresented and sadly misunderstood. In Luke chapter 9, verse 24, Jesus warns us that the life that we were created to live could be lost by pursuing all the wrong things, by mistaking where life really comes from. He said, if anyone tries to save his life, he will lose it. But anyone who would lose his life for my sake will be saved, will find life. Again, he tells us in John chapter 10, let me read his words. Beginning in verse 7, he says, I tell you the truth, I am the gate for the sheep. The sheep being you and me. All who ever came before me were thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. He will come in and go out and find green pasture. The thief comes only to steal and to kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. How many times have we reversed the imagery and somehow suppose that what Jesus does is he calls us into the pen. He brings us into the gate so that we can be surrounded by the fence, so we can be protected from the outside world. But Jesus says the exact opposite. He said, I am the life gate. If you'll step into me and pass through me, you'll step out of the fenced-in area full of security and safety and predictability, and you will be set free to run in the pasture so green and wild and lush. Mysterious, dangerous, open spaces that could only be described as life itself. Jesus is the great adventurer, the one who was willing even to step into death so that he could not only bring life afresh for himself, but for everyone who would dare to receive his invitation. He calls you to be an explorer, a pioneer, a sojourner. Yes, even an alien and stranger in this world. Not an aimless wanderer, but a mystic explorer of mysteries yet undiscovered. In Jesus Christ, there is the invitation, the promise, that you will climb mountains so high they will take your breath away. You will stand on summits with air so clear you will see beyond your wildest imagination. Yet the great tragedy is that many of us, not just outside of a relationship to God in Jesus Christ, but even many of us inside of this relationship with Jesus Christ, have been paralyzed by fear, standing at base camp, too terrified to take on the great adventure. God calls us all on an adventure. Each one different, distinct, unique, but each one filled with mystery, danger, requiring faith, courage. There's one event in the scriptures in 1 Samuel chapter 14 that gives us some insight on how, as we begin to move in this adventure that God calls us on, how we can seize the divine moments of life. How we can make sure that we step into all that God has for us. I want you to turn there with me, 1 Samuel 14. And I'm going to begin reading in verse 1. You have the story of two individuals, one Saul, one Jonathan. Same moment, Same opportunity, same circumstance, same challenge, but different result, different adventure, different life lived. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man bearing his armor, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men, among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. He was the son of Ichabod's brother Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. We won't be saying that again tonight. No one was aware that Jonathan had left. On each side of the pass that Jonathan had intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez, the other Senech. One cliff to the north toward Michmash, the other toward the south toward Geba. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised fellows. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." "Do all that you have in mind," his armor bearer said. "Go ahead, I am with you heart and soul." Jonathan said, "Come then, we will cross over toward the men and let them see us. If they say to us, 'Wait there until we come to you,' we will stay where we are and we will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands." So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. "Look," said the Philistines, "the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in." The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us and we will teach you a lesson." So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come, climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hands of Israel." Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet with his armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in the area of about a half an acre. Then panic struck the whole army. Those in the camp and field and those in the outposts and raiding parties, and the ground shook. And it was a panic sent by God. Saul's lookouts at Gibeah and Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. Then Saul said to the men who were with him, "Muster the forces and see who has left us." When they did it was Jonathan and his armor bearer who were not there. Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God." All that time it was with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all of his men assembled and went into battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. With all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim, heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So the Lord rescued Israel that day, and the battle moved on beyond Beth Aven. Saul and Jonathan, two individuals facing the same dilemma, the same circumstance, the same challenge, having two dramatically different outcomes, two moments that appear so different. One filled with the mundane, the normal, the expected, the predictable. The other packed with the miraculous, rich and thick, with divine opportunity. The scenario is pretty straightforward. Israel and the Philistines were at war. God had commanded Israel to go and take the land. He wanted to establish a nation that would declare his name, that would expand his fame and declare the life he offered all the nations so that even the Philistines would come to worship the true and living God. And so Israel was commanded to go to war against the Philistines, and God had promised them that he would bring them victory. But there was a certain problem. There were only two swords in all of Israel. And so though Saul had 600 warriors with him, only two had swords. One was, of course, King Saul, and the other was Prince Jonathan, his son. You see, it does matter who you know, not what you know. And so Saul and Jonathan were the two with weapons. The other 600 soldiers were defenseless. Now, if you were King Saul, you would understand. You would perhaps make the same decision. How could you possibly go to war under a crypt like this? It's obvious that even if this is God's purpose, if this is God's will, it certainly is not God's timing. I mean, God is not expecting you to go pick a fight with the Philistines, these oversized giants who are also overarmed. To expect me to take my 600 men who have no weapons at all to their certain death. Now, that little genealogy that's there, it's not there just to make the Bible longer. It's not there just to make you feel stupid. It's not there to give you practice, Hebraic names. It's there for a reason. And what God is trying to lay out, what Samuel is trying to make clear, is that Saul had all the military authority, all the political authority, and all the spiritual authority to engage the Philistines and bring the victory that God promised. The priest of God was there with Saul. And the Ark of the Covenant was there also. And it was the promise of God's presence and victory. And though some strange things had happened in the past, the Ark was God's promise of his presence, that he would be in control of the outcome if they would trust him. But instead, Saul decided to sit on a pomegranate tree, to rest in the shade of the pomegranate. And so all the army forgot the battle, they forgot the war, they abandoned the purpose, and they just sat around and rested. And so then we find in verse 1, the most critical verse in this entire story. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to his young man bearing his armor, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. In the middle of the night, Jonathan awoke. And in his restlessness, he didn't just think about or dream about or imagine all the possibilities of what could happen if someone sees this moment. He got up out of his tent or rose out of his bed. He woke up the one person that he knew he could trust and was entrusted to him, his armor bearer, and he said, "Let's go. Pick a fight. Let's go see what God might do." See, all of us are time travelers. Now, I'm one of those kids that grew up with H.G. Wells and the time machine, and I've always been fascinated with time travel. I've always wondered, would we ever get to travel through time? Have you ever wondered that? I mean, space, 1960s kind of proved we could make it to the moon and we could get out into space, and space is a very cool frontier, but space really doesn't compare to time. Time travel, I think, would probably be the edge of all experience. But one thing we have to remember is that even though we don't seem suited for time travel, we're actually all time travelers. Every one of us, we're designed to travel through time. There are just certain limitations. You can't travel backwards. You always travel forward, and you can't leap into different eras of time. You can travel through time one moment at a time. Every one of us, do you feel it? There's a moment passing by. All of us are traveling through time, moving, pressing into the future, leaving behind, leaving in our dust the now. And we call that the past. It's one of the reasons I love Monet. Monet had an accurate picture of what time and motion and movement and moments were really all about. We've all been corrupted by the photograph. We see the still shot. We see life stationary, stagnant, immovable. We think we can actually see a moment with such clarity that it lacks movement and motion. But Monet knew better than that. The master of light and movement, his paintings were oftentimes a blur, an image of beauty captured because he saw what was really there. Kim was telling me this was kind of this visual acuity that allows a person to see things for what they really are. It's what Da Vinci classified as one of his phases of genius or achievement, the ability to see what's really there. Can you see the movement in a moment? Kim was also describing to me that one of Monet's kind of compulsive activities was he would have multiple canvases when he was painting as the sun was setting. Because every time the sun would move and the light would change and the shadows would shift on whatever object he was painting, he would leave that canvas and move to the next canvas. And when the light would shift again, he would move to the next canvas, trying to catch what he really saw, what was really there in that moment. I wonder how many of us actually see what's really there in the moment. Do we really see that there's a reason that the core word of moments and the core word of motion are from the same center? I was looking up the different meanings or descriptives of the word moment, pulled out of the thesaurus, and here are some of the words that describe a moment: instant, flash, blink, twinkling of an eye, split second, minute. In other words, something so small that if you're not careful, if you're not paying careful attention, if you're ignoring the importance of the moment, it'll just pass you by and it'll be gone. But then he goes on, instant, flash, blink, twinkling of an eye, split second, minute, and it seems to shift. Hour, day, chapter, phase, season, age, generation, era, epoch. We find that not only do words that seem to describe the twinkling of an eye describe a moment, but words that describe a movement so powerful that it could last an epoch, whatever an epoch is. You see, the core word for moment is the word atomos, which is the same word for atom. A particle so small that you could ignore it and easily miss it, but filled with so much potential that if it is seized, it could create a catalytic atomic reaction that would have eternal significance and ramification. Have you ever seen a moment's potential after the moment was gone? Oh man, I missed it. Have you ever seen that window of opportunity, but you didn't treasure it, and you thought maybe it would be there later, but when you came back, it was closed? Moment lost. See, one thing we know for certain about moments is that moments, once they are missed, are irretrievable. You can never see those moments again. They are gone forever. And sometimes what happens is that either a moment missed or a moment poorly lived. Sometimes it's a moment that has caused us great pain, or a moment where we caused someone else great pain, or a moment where we caused ourselves great pain. And we get stuck in a moment. You've been stuck in a moment that you couldn't get out of? You know, a moment from the past that you keep reliving over and over again? I don't think it's incidental that U2 and their CD, All That You Can't Leave Behind, has their hit song, Beautiful Day, and everybody loves that song, and it made it into, all the television shows and all over, just spread all, because everybody wants to have a beautiful day, right? But there's a song right after A Beautiful Day, and it's sort of a reminder that every day isn't that beautiful. It's stuck in a moment you can't get out of. And there's an icon for every song, and the icon for Stuck in a Moment is four arrows pointing inward to a dot. Have you ever been stuck there? You ever been stuck in a moment, and you just keep reliving it, and you know what it does? When you are trying to seize a moment in your past, that's called regret. But when you're living in a moment that you've lost already, what it's doing is ensuring that you will lose every moment that you're passing through right now. Are you stuck in a moment you can't get out of? Well, let me sing it for you. Well, why do people laugh when I say that? You're stuck in a moment you can't get out of. You keep missing moments that are rich with opportunity. So the difficulty with seizing divine moments is that every moment kind of looks the same up front, doesn't it? See, every moment isn't the same in life. Every moment is not equal. Some moments are skinny with opportunity, but other moments are fat with potential. They are rich with divine capacity. And the difficulty is that if you don't treasure every moment, you cannot know up front which moments are the ones that will just absolutely erupt with a catalytic reaction that will change your life and the lives of others. You have to treat every moment as precious, because they don't come with a forewarning of the spectacular nature of what may be hidden behind the curtain. And so we step into the moments, they look so ordinary, they just seem so much the same. Why is it that some people just are able to see through the curtain of the ordinary and squeeze out of it the miraculous and extraordinary? Well, for one, they live their lives operating on a genuinely spiritual level. Now let me give you an example. When you think of a spiritual activity, what would one be? Describe something spiritual that you do. Pray, thank you. Worship, come on. For those of you listening on tape, there are people in this room. Sing, read. The most spiritual activity that you do, what is it?
Love.
Take out the trash. We have an extra room available.
What? Spiritual activity.
Serving.
Fasting. What's that? Study. See, these are all spiritual activities, aren't they? Fasting, praying, reading, studying, serving, taking out the garbage, loving people. All this is spiritual stuff. But these are not the most spiritual activity that you were created to perform. The most spiritual activity that you will engage in today is making choices. There is nothing more spiritual that we do than make choices throughout our lives. That may be the epicenter of the ramifications of being created in the image and likeness of God. There may be nothing more central to the fact that God created you differently than all the creation on this planet than your capacity to choose. You've been given this gift by God. And in the moments that we live, we have choices we have to make. And God shows us that the moments are fluid and they can actually be so mysterious that you miss the power of it. In Isaiah, the Lord says this, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he's near." Some moments he's near and some he's far. Paul said it like this, "Today is the day of salvation. Now is the appointed time." This is the moment, Paul says. And the way we capture those moments, the way we unlock those moments, the way we seize divine moments is by making choices. Every one of us have given this responsibility. And there are some choices in your life that God would not allow anyone to make for you. They are your choices to make, good or bad, right or wrong. They're in your hands. You have to choose whether to take the red pill or the blue pill.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends, you wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
God puts it like this in Deuteronomy chapter 30, beginning in verse 11. Listen to his words. Now, what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. I love when God begins this way. This isn't that hard, he's saying. This is a no-brainer. Now, what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven so that you have to say, who will ascend into heaven? To get it and proclaim it to us that we may obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea so that you have to ask, who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it? No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so you may obey it. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away, and you are not obedient, and you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. This day, I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life. God says, now choose life so that you and your children may live, and that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, and hold fast to him, for the Lord is your life. God said it first. It's a choice you have to make. One choice allows you to live your life in the delusion of living, but all you'll have is existence. The other choice, as dangerous and frightening as it may seem, will set you free to truly live. God explains that he's the creator, the designer, the giver of life. He is the essence and source of all living. And so Jesus says, I have come to give you life and give it to you in the full. Jesus Christ himself says, choose life and you will live beyond your wildest imagination. But there is a choice set before you. And the power that you and I have is to choose life or death, freedom or captivity. Now, I wish there was just a blue pill and a red pill to choose from. But because of Adam, we are now in this multicolored experience. And the choices are endless in their variation and design. There's the orange choice and the yellow choice and the green choice and that oh so tempting watermelon color choice, the white choice that looks right, but later you find out it was wrong and and then, for only those rare, refined tastes, the black jelly bean choice. See, I'm still ticked at Adam. I mean, he blew it. He had not just two pills, one bad pill, just one bad jelly bean. Don't choose it, Adam. All the other jelly beans are yours. He had a garden full of jelly beans. Fruit, whatever you call it. And it was so simple, wasn't it? There's a choice set before you. Isn't the garden all about the power to choose? And God made it so simple because he wanted us to win. He wanted us to make the right choice. And so he said, one bad choice. Right over here. Tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat the fruit off of this tree. Everything else you can have, everything else is good. I mean, you can go crazy on everything else. But no. They got to have this one. And I started thinking, you know, it must have been a very, very attractive tree. The aroma of the fruit must have been extraordinary.
It must have had a texture that looked very appetizing. It must be very leafy. And I thought, well, maybe God was sort of like being unfair, you know, being a little bit malevolent in his choice giving. I mean, maybe the garden was so tight. You know what I mean? It was like so tight that they couldn't get away from the tree. Yeah. So it's like, okay, no, we can't eat from this one. We gotta eat from this one. Can't eat this one. You know what I mean? I wonder if you're like, but it's always within reach. But I checked. I looked throughout the whole Bible, and the garden had no boundaries at all. The whole earth was God's garden to Adam and Eve. And there are four rivers described in the book of Genesis, but they all flow out. They're not some boundary created by dangerous waters that force them to always be pressed against the bad tree. Why didn't Adam cut down a couple of branches, build a raft, sweep Eve off of her feet and say, baby, I'm introducing you to the love boat. We are going down the Euphrates and we're going to check out the very ends of paradise. You and me are going on an adventure. Let's get as far away from this tree as we can. But we just keep hanging around rather than running free, don't we? It makes more sense to me when the psalmist says in Psalm 119:32, I run in the path of your commands, for you have set my heart free. See, what God is not doing is placing anchors and chains and anvils and burdens on us. He's not trying to hold us down from living life to the fullest. He's has come to break the power and the chains and to rip us away from all the weight that holds us back from really living. He says, I run in the path of your commands, not crawl or drag all the stuff behind. I'm running in the path because you have set my heart free. You can choose to live. You can choose to step into the relationship that Jesus Christ died for you and me to have. Jesus has come and become this life gate, so if we enter in and through him, we can run free. Man, just take off your socks and shoes and run in the green pastures of paradise. Just begin to dream with God and experience a life beyond your comprehension. Stop playing it safe. Stop holding it too close. Stop hoping God will give you security and safety and comfort and predictability, because that kind of life simply bores God. God wants to set you free. He wants you to stop hanging around and run free. And I look throughout the Bible and I find all these men and women who stepped into a moment, made a choice, and their lives were changed forever. And I see in Moses, a guy who blew it. He killed someone, lost another 40 years of his life. His life at 80 years old, he delivers Israel out of Egypt. And I'm reminded that when you blow it in a moment, you don't have to live in that moment. You don't have to be stuck in that moment, because God will give you another moment so rich with opportunity that it will change your future forever. I'm reminded by Rahab, this prostitute who lived a worthless life, empty, destitute, desperate, wicked, vile, how good is always just one choice away. I'm reminded by Caleb, who made a great choice, but everyone else around him made a bad choice. So his good choice and all the benefit was deferred for 45 years, that even when you make good choices, when you go through hard times, the good choice will come back to you, because God will return to you that moment when you seized it, when you captured it, when you stepped into his divine opportunity. I'm reminded by Abraham that the choice we make in those divine moments will cause us at times to surrender everything we have, all that we know, all that belongs to us, all that we treasure, for just the possibility, the potential of all that God sees in a mysterious journey that we cannot see through the mist. That in a moment of choice, God would call you and me to give up everything to follow him, so that we can receive everything that comes in knowing Him. But each one of them had to choose. And each one of them chose not to hang around, but to run free. I wonder tonight, what's your choice going to be? Hang around, run free. Hang around, or run free. There's a journey, there's an adventure waiting for you. There's a moment rich with opportunity right in front of you. What choice will you make? Would you bow your heads with me just for a moment? Every moment is not the same. Some moments are compacted with God opportunity. To neglect them is to lose a God-dreamed opportunity with a future and hope. To seize them is to watch your life become a catalyst for good. Tonight, if you're here and you have not yet yielded your life to Jesus Christ, you've not yet bowed before the Lord who created you, who allowed Himself to be killed on your behalf, who was crucified and raised from the dead. If you have not to this day chosen to follow Him, but tonight you don't want to miss the moment. If tonight you would say, Jesus, this moment I give you my life for all eternity. I want you right now just to talk to God and say, God, I give you myself. I seize this moment. I choose to give you my life. Just tell Him right now. Don't miss the moment. You may be here, and best you know, you've been a follower of Christ, or at least you've believed in Jesus, but your life is really a sad reflection of the adventure Jesus calls you on. You have settled for so much less. You've let so many moments slip away. To die unseized. All the gifts inside of them lost. And tonight, you need to get back on the path. I just want you right now to tell God, God, I will not surrender the adventure. I want to follow you, Jesus. I don't want to be paralyzed. Jesus wants to take you where only dead men and women can go. He wants to take you on an adventure where those who are paralyzed by fear will never walk. And only those who fear nothing but God will dare endeavor. Father, I pray, God, that you would see hearts in this room who have opened up themselves to your great adventure, Jesus. That we would understand that you risked everything for life. And you invite us to pass through your life gate and join you in that life experience. I pray, God, that you would hear every prayer tonight that says, Jesus, I yield my life to you. I give myself to you. I choose to become your follower tonight. And that, God, you would just wrap them up in your love. And let them know that they belong to you. And, God, just pull them on the journey. May they have their own version of the perils of Eden and begin to discover the life you created them to love. I pray, God, that you would just soften hardened hearts. God, just break the callousness. God, help us to overcome the fear and the doubt that robs us from the life you came for us to live. And I pray, Jesus, that you would teach us how to have the eyes to see, the visual acuity to see life and opportunity for what it really is, and to seize every moment of the adventure. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Mosaic Podcast. As God has spoken into your life, one of the things that Jesus teaches us is that when we've been invested in, we need to also become investors. And I want to encourage you right now, if Mosaic is one of the platforms from which you grow spiritually, you connect more deeply to God, and your faith with Jesus becomes more real, I want to encourage you right now to go to mosaic.org and become one of our givers. Give a one-time gift, become a recurring giver. Mosaic isn't just a church in Los Angeles. Mosaic is all of us working together.